Awesome. Awesome. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Creating the Future's Integrity Team slash Board Meeting, June of 2026. It is awesome to be with you all. It has been a while. So let's just catch up a little bit. If you are watching via our website, please note that if you click through to YouTube, that's the only place we'll be looking for comments. So if you've got comments, just put them in the YouTube stream and we will be keeping an eye out for them. And please dive in if there's anything that interests you, including what's going on in your life right now, let us know. So, hey gang, so who wants to go first? What's been going on in your world? What's meaningful? What's happening?
So I'll start.
Okay. Go ahead, Justin. Good.
I'm Justin Pollock. I'm located in Washington, D.C. It's summer has set in here, which it took a little while to get here, which I appreciated, but now we've settled into really hot and gross. I had the opportunity. So I grew up on the West Coast. I still have a very West Coast bias when it comes to the outdoors and the environment. However, one thing that is somewhat incredible about Washington, D.C. is there's a lot of parkland embedded in the city, and we have the Potomac River. So yesterday I was able to go out and see juvenile bald eagles and be out on the river kayaking and feel like there was no UFC fight happening in my backyard.
All of those things are very, very good. Yeah, I got to experience. I was staying. I just got back yesterday, and I was staying right across the street from Franklin Square, where they had huge, big screen TVs, and the entire park was just filled with people watching the World Cup. It was just, yeah, pretty delightful. The number of parks around in just tiny little places within the urban core, and then on the outside, pretty beautiful, pretty wonderful capital city. What else is going on with everybody? Angie, I know that you had a big one this past weekend.
Yeah, I was actually in DC and I'm sorry I missed you. We were taking my daughter to her onboarding. She just left for Peace Corps Liberia. She left on Saturday morning. So kind of like excited for her and also sad that she has gone away for 2+ years. But hopefully we get to go visit her at some point. And the other exciting thing that happened is we took a kind of long trip down. We stopped in New York for a couple of nights, and we happened to be there for like game three of the NBA Finals. So unfortunately, the night they lost, but it was insane. So I can only imagine what it was like when they won on Saturday, because it was just like it was so nutty. It was like the St. Patrick's Day just amped up. Everybody was all excited and rooting for the Knicks, and so it was exciting to see them win. And even though I'm a UConn, so we've got our own basketball biases here, but definitely like it was an awesome, fun to be part of that.
Yeah. It's always fun to be part of those big things. Yeah. Awesome. What else is going on with everybody? Where are you and what's going on in your life?
Hey everyone.
Oh yeah, go ahead, Boo.
I'm so sorry. I'm actually in New York. I was here when the Knicks won, and all the streets were honking. We opened the windows, and it was just really loud. People were stuck on the road for a while trying to get home. But everyone was still happy. And no one burned a couch like the way when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. People just started burning couches. I'm like, we won. Why are you burning couches? But anyways, I'm doing okay. Just traveling here. Heading to Charlotte to yell at people about stuff. That's usual.
the voo drill anymore. Shantine, what's going on?
Hi, good morning, everybody. Well, this is my first full summer in Portland since moving here. So I am just loving it, kind of staying on theme with the glory of the outdoors. We have so many beautiful parks here. The roses are fully bloomed. It's just absolutely gorgeous. We're just walking around the city taking pictures of everything because it's hard to describe how beautiful and well kept the city is. And particularly in light of the last year that we've had here in Portland, of the media trying to make it look like a fiery hellhole, it's never been that way. And in fact, it's always been quite the opposite, the just most gorgeous city with really beautiful people in it. So we're having a wonderful time just being outdoors and going to the park. I take my dog every day, so I'm really lucky to do that because he's the reason I get to see the morning sun and be outside. And we had an awesome Washington Square set up with the World Cup. They were showing it on huge screens, and that was incredible. The city's just always alive, but it's really alive right now with World Cup madness, which suits me as a big soccer fan. So yeah, it's a beautiful summer. No complaints over here.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm glad you're here.
Thanks.
How
I
about
guess
you, John?
that leaves me. So, hi everybody. Good to see all of you. Missed you. I missed our meetings. I'm glad that we're getting together, but glad that you were too busy to get together, doing great work. So, thank you for that. I am heading off to Las Vegas after this meeting to hang out with my grandson for a few days. His mom is saying he needs some man time, so I'm gonna spend some time with him. So I'm excited about that. Looking forward to that. Let's see. And I'm taking notes for this meeting. So just I'll go ahead and do the transcript after we finish. So just everybody know I'm taking notes. And then the other great thing is just figuring out some work that I feel like I want to do. I came really close to being in your consulting classes, but just things didn't quite work out, but they did inspire me. And so now I feel really good because it was something I wanted to do and get an opportunity to work with organizations and help them be better.
Wonderful, wonderful, and they need you. So
Thank you.
I am really excited about this.
Thank you.
How about you, Dimitri?
Well, in keeping with the outdoor theme, we have experienced last night and today a huge thunderstorm, tons of rain. Our monsoon season seems to be about a month early. That's great. We can always use all the water we can get here, but it's just beautiful to look outside and to see. We've got some downspouts and some channels that, and the channels are full and not draining because so much water has been coming down. So it's been amazing. And the second thing is, a couple of years ago, I had my bike stolen, my dear friend bike that I'd had for years and years and years, which was very comfortable to ride. And this weekend, I finally found the exact same bike, which I had been looking for. And so I look forward to experiencing the outdoors on my very comfy bike. And it's, I want to say it's an old guy's bike, except I've been riding that bike for almost 20 years. So I guess I was an old guy 20 years ago when I started riding the bike.
Yeah, it is exciting. And Justin had actually been asking me a couple of weeks ago if you were riding, and I was explaining that you weren't as much because you didn't love the replacement bike you got. So this has been exciting. I am Hilde Gottlieb with Creating the Future. I'm located in Tucson, Arizona, the traditional unceded lands of the Tohono O'odham people and the Pasquayaki people, and life is just so rich these days. I don't even know where to start. My best awesome was that I got to spend time with Justin and Vu over the past couple of days. And that was just delicious and delightful, and lots of laughing and lots of hanging out, which got to see Justin twice in the past month, which is really awesome. The fact that I finally got to meet Karen, your wife, which is probably a decade overdue. So all of it good. Disappointed, Angie, that we missed each other. Would have been really wonderful. The work that we're doing, the work that I was doing this past week was with the National Council of Nonprofits. And that will eventually, over the next couple of months, trickle into catalytic thinking being used as the basis of a series of summits they are planning to have in every state across the country. So, the statewide associations of every state in the US will be rolling out this project, asking the questions of catalytic thinking to figure out what would good look like for the nonprofit sector. What needs to be in place for nonprofits to be able to accomplish everything they have the potential to accomplish. It is a joy. It is a pleasure. We rolled out with a beta over the weekend, last week, I guess it was Friday, just testing the questions and seeing how they roll. And it's just really, really exciting. The other exciting thing, thank you, Angie, is that we've got this delicious, delicious, delightful doctoral student working with us on documenting the results of all of the work that we've done at Creating the Future. Things are just good. Things are just rocking and they're good. And it rained. And while that may not seem awesome for some of you, it is really awesome for us. Woke up with lightning and thunder and just downpour. And what we get here in the desert, because we get monsoon rains, we get sideways rain because the wind sweeps in. It's 30, 40 miles an hour. When my daughter first moved to New York before DC, when she first moved to New York 20 years ago, she called me and she said, "The rain here is weird." And I said, "What do you mean weird?" She said, "It just comes slowly down out of the sky." And I went, "Yeah, that's what rain looks like in most places." But here we have that delicious windy rain and the lightning and the thunder. And so my
And it goes
visit.
away and the sun comes up.
And then it goes away and the sun comes up. And it has cooled down. So just delightful to be with all of you and to be tackling this topic. Diving into the topic of setting salaries as we start fundraising and raising money to dive into the last portion of Creating the Future's mission. That's going to include hiring people. We've spent some time talking about hiring policies last year. And now we're, getting down to the, okay, how do we set salaries? How do we set salaries for my position as whatever that's called? People keep asking, they wanted a title for my thing this past week. And I was like, pick one, CEO, founder, I don't know. I don't know. But what will it, what will salaries be set upon? We've never really talked about that. We've never really had to. But now that we're going to be really raising money for a big push with big money coming in, hopefully, it's time to really be talking about what do we want to base setting salaries on? What does that look like? And before we dive into that, Kim, do you want to say hello? I'm glad you're here.
I'm so sorry I'm late.
I can't hear. Did I have mine not set?
Can everyone else hear me?
I've heard people. Can you guys hear Kim? You can, and I can't.
I can go back out and come back in, see if that fixes it.
All right. I'll figure that out. Kim, you welcome and come on in, and I'm going to figure out why I can't hear. Go.
Can you okay?
I can hear you now. Guess what? If you turn the speaker on, it works.
I'm glad it could have been on my side because I am babysitting kittens right now and they're everywhere. And I apologize. That's what you'll see running across my screen right now.
Never
So,
apologize for kittens. No. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's good to see you.
yes, and I'm so sorry I'm late. but thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation. I just was interested in this. It comes up all the time, so I was just curious to see how you folks work through it. So.
Yep. Us too. Us too. So, let's start at the beginning as we talk about setting salaries for creating the future. And obviously, have this discussion openly so that anybody can hear it, listen to it, and think about it. Who will be affected by whatever we decide in terms of setting salaries? I mean, we can start. How about staff at Creating the Future? We'll start with that. Okay. Moving beyond that, as we look at the ripples, who might be affected by whatever we decide?
So, if I chime in here, I also have not babysitting kittens. I just have my cat who will un unfortunately cross over, or fortunately, a few times. So I saw. I'm sorry, but not that sorry. He's very cute. So, with salary for particularly nonprofits, there is, I'm sure as you're all aware, a reasonableness standard for what is set, particularly for executives, directors, CEOs, founders, et cetera. So when we look at that, we first of all want to compare and look at what a reasonable salary is. We look at other data from other comparable nonprofits, but sort of the reverse is also true. Depending on what is set, it can then affect other nonprofits with how they establish their reasonableness standards. So if you hit, bare minimum, that might be fine from a reasonableness standard, but then you're also kind of projecting out to the rest of the world, the other nonprofits, that here's what how we value this work. And if they try to exceed that, now the IRS may be knocking on their door saying, well, Creating the Future gets by with this, other similar nonprofits, how come you need more? And so I think there's a real respect to pay to how we fit into the community of nonprofits when we establish salaries.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, Shantine still maintains her license, is not very, very active, but was for quite a long time a labor lawyer.
That is accurate. Yes, these days I'm working on other things, but I'm going to keep that California license going as long as I can. And use my brain a few times a week at least in this regard. But yes, thank you, Hildy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, what we are all collectively doing is setting what the market is, because that's what we're always told, what are market rates for X position within a nonprofit? And by that, maintaining whatever quote standards have been set in there. Yeah, John.
Yeah, I think the other piece of this has to be mindset that a lot, years and years ago, not too many years ago, but a few years ago, I was at a listening conference and a listening summit. And, one of the speakers started with, we know how to do more with less. And I think that mentality is dangerous because it really creates the issue of you don't really appreciate the value of the work. And so one of the many things that I think we have to keep in mind is that we are defining how important we don't think our work is through our salaries. And I think that's really a key, it not only impacts the people in our organizations, but it impacts the people we serve as well, because they feel like they're getting substandard people because we're paying them substandard wages. So So I think that that's very important.
Huge. Yeah, in a society that places so much value based on money. Yeah, huge, John.
Well, I think if I were to sort of dovetail off of what, I mean, I think John and Shantine, you're sort of both talking about that framing. But if we think about who's affected, I think just, not to do sort of the cop out of the broader community, but this idea of the community who is affected by employment. I mean, just in general. So people who are just engaged in employment in the community across sectors, not just the nonprofit. To John's point, what we do will affect them. And then, certainly, I think if we look at kind of the, extended definition of family and dependents, so whomever the person is and their, both social, familial, and, economic life, but I think most particularly sort of their family, their dependents, the other people who have a vested interest in their economic well-being.
Justin, talk a little bit more about your first point about people engaged in employment in general.
Well, I just think to Shantine's point around, when people look around, like you said, Hildy, what does someone get paid for something like this? We are indirectly impacting that because we are setting what we consider to be a wage. And I think there is also then, I mean, if depending on where we sort of head with this, but if we start talking about things like, livable wages and sustainable wages and things like that, again, that's not only going to affect people who are employed, but then I think that also then starts to, depending on the language we use, it then starts to ripple out to policymakers, because we are, we are creating a frame of reference.
Yeah, Shantine.
You're
You're
muted.
muted, Shantine.
Sorry about that. I was lowering my hand, not unmuting. I think those are really great points. And one of the things that I think about a lot with respect to nonprofits, particularly, is the concept that volunteers are wonderful, but volunteers are non-paid. And that means not everyone can volunteer. It's a really pr real privilege for people to have time, energy, and also have enough money and funding behind them to be able to contribute their time freely. So when we transfer over volunteer positions to paid positions, whether that's a direct transfer or it's saying we no longer need as many volunteers because we now have paid or vice versa, we have to consider how that might impact people who have the free time to volunteer and now people who don't, and how that interplays. So there will be people who will be able to operate as sort of a contributor or funder of a employee because they're going to be paid, and then there are people who won't. And that really speaks a lot to what's happening in a particular community. The way that the world is right now, volunteership is down. That is not unexpected from how with the prices with the way they are, inflation, et cetera, but it is something to take into account. And as you create these paid positions, how does that change the demographics of people who are participating? Because it most likely will happen.
Huge. That's a huge factor. Wow. Welcome, Carl. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're here. We're diving into who will be affected by how we set salaries at Creating the Future. With rich conversation, obviously, beyond this, just the staff at Creating the Future, the ripples out of that, the mindset shift, the market shift, the families of people working in nonprofits, policymakers. You came in on the tail end of Shantine talking about how that shifts volunteers and how we think about volunteers, and who is able to volunteer. And one of the things that y'all have me thinking about is It affects the mission of any nonprofit. If you can't afford, quote unquote, well, we can't pay that. If you can't afford to pay people, how much of, I know that for years, NCN has been dealing with questions of burnout and workforce development, that nonprofits having trouble hiring because the private sector pays so much for exact same position that may even be less work. And so if we're talking about the ability to deliver mission, now we're talking about things like burnout. Now we're talking about things like turnover. These are big issues, many of which all revolve around salary. Welcome, Eli. It is so good to see. I think we see your face. We see your picture.
Hi, Hildy. Hey, everyone. It's been a while. Glad to be back. I'll be off video, but I'll be listening and see if I can contribute.
That sounds wonderful. We're glad you're here. We're starting to talk about setting salaries and who will be affected by whatever salaries we set at Creating the Future, and the power of what that ripples out to. Anyone else? Kim, yeah.
I think this is kind of exciting because you don't have like stuff already in place. Whereas like when I took over as ED of our organization, like we have funding that is like long-term funding. Like we've just got it a lot and it's frameworked and this is what I can pay for salaries and that's it. And so I think like this is really exciting to be able to not have to think about it in that way, because what we've had to do is with our funders. So affecting the funders is try to like impart to them the importance of investing in people, because we have things to do our jobs, but the people are what are actually doing the jobs. And so over the years, because we keep saying it, we've had a number of funders. They can't just give us more money, but when they do have a little bit more money, like other city funders said, hey, this goes towards salaries, this little raise, that increase that we gave you. And then we had some unrestricted funding, and that can go towards anything, which was amazing. And then we have another funder who's more flexible, like we can do that. So the funders in those conversations, if you have that framework already, is really important. And I think it's not most of them. Most of our funders get it. It's just their hands are tied by policy, by whatever it is. So.
Huge, tremendous. I mean, someone mentioned, I don't remember, it may have been you, Justin, I don't remember, policymakers. But so much of the policy, quote unquote, is economic policy, is set by funders, is set by government funders, is set by private funders. And it may not even be with an explicit cap. They're just tacitly not funding well. The whole, ridiculous bullshit overhead question of, what percentage overhead? I don't want to fund overhead, which is saying I don't want to fund people, and you're paying your people too much. And yeah, it's tremendous, Kim. Thank you. Carl.
Hi everyone. Hildy, I really like that last bit when essentially you were highlighting that this is a power play. And it's not that you can't fund salaries, it's that you won't fund salaries. Well, if I go back to the thing that I shared with you about John Gaventa and his power cube and the invisible power of funders, and that leads us to conclude that something's not possible. And the salaries thing is one of them. The observation I was actually going to make was several years ago when I still worked full time in the nonprofit sector, and the issue of salaries came up. It was the old chestnut of certain newspapers complaining about high salaries in the nonprofit sector. And we did a large piece of work looking at salaries in the sector. And guess what? It turned out that actually all those who were receiving the highest salaries, I mean, in comparison to those working in the for-profit sector or the public sector, for example, they were operating at times at quite a substantial discount for running big organizations. But the real story was at the other end of the scale. and the large proportions of people working in the sector that were paid at sort of at or around the living wage and sort of barely about. But nobody wanted to talk about low pay in the sector because it didn't suit their political agenda. They only wanted to talk about high pay. So, in your point about who is affected by this, it potentially enables us to broaden the conversation and shift the terms of the debate away from high pay, which I think is a red herring, to low pay.
Trying to capture all of this because I think best when I'm writing, but that's brilliant, Carl. Yes. Yeah.
I think that opens the door also to talking about organizing, labor organizing in the nonprofit sector, which has been, the same people that are often sometimes that are advocating for social equity and justice are also like anti-union, right? And anti-organizing because of all of the issues that we've already been talking about they bring up. So having some more discussion around that would also be, I think, useful to the sector and the field.
Yeah, and sometimes they're very pro-labor for everybody else, but you're going to unionize our shop? Yeah, Dimitri.
Years ago, when I was actively working as an organizer, and in our office, we had some support staff, and they were represented by their own union. And it was very interesting to, as a union, to be dealing with another union about this exact issue: is what was the secretary's pay scale going to be, and what was her benefit package going to be? And there was some resentment around the idea of, well, don't you believe in our cause? Don't you believe in what we're doing? You realize that if we pay you more, we won't be able to do whatever. So I think that there's also within this sector that sort of emotional hammer of coming in and saying, well, you obviously aren't a true believer in this, because if you were, you wouldn't be saying, I need to be paid more, i.e., a decent living wage, versus just what we've decided we can pay you right now.
Tremendous. Yeah, Kim.
I was just thinking about another conversation we've had recently about because we don't have the money to bring everyone up to where we would like them to be. We talk a lot about the benefits that we can offer that aren't like the traditional like health and wellness type of benefits. So in our organization, we give a lot of flexibility. So if people have kids, they can go pick up their kids when they need to. Like, so there's other pieces to salaries, I think, that have to be thought about too, because we've gotten really creative. So like all summer we give everyone Fridays off. That's not included in their vacation. We have a 2 week break at Christmas that everyone gets. So like there's other pieces that can help. I don't think it replaces what salary should be at, but it's one of those things that we do look at constantly, right or wrong, whether we have to do it or should be doing it that way or not. It is something that has benefited our staff tremendously.
Yeah, we wind up trying to make up for it in other places. Yeah, John.
Yeah, I think there's also the career question, right? Because when I start my career, it's like, okay, I'm gonna go here, work, earn this, I'll get a promotion, I'll make that. And there is this kind of ladder. A lot of times you go into a nonprofit, that salary that we are setting is in perpetuity, right? They never see a raise, they never see progression. People don't move. That fits into it as well, because you get stuck. I mean, and it backs up everything under it, and so the organization never gets the benefit of the best and the brightest, because the best and the brightest are like, why would I ever do that to my family, to myself, and to my community? And so I know, looking at it from that perspective, it's not just compensation per se, it's the whole structure of career opportunity. And I just think it's not a career with a great opportunity tied to it. And it's just kind of like a sentence. I hate to say that, right? But it's almost like we sentence you to live at this salary for the rest of your life until I die. And so there's a horrible that part of it is as important. And that's the other reason I don't think we get as many young people who feel, I could start here because there's no else, there's no up once they start. It's like where I start is where I'm stuck. And the other thing that I always feel distraught about is I think that the work we do is not just, helpful. I think it's some of the most valuable work that can be done. We work with people, but we make it like it's not like valuable. I mean, we pay, you have to be as skilled as any CEO to actually navigate the waters. And so we ask people to accept that, or we accept people who are really not, not that feel that way. And I think that's the other piece. I'm working with a group and we were talking about setting salaries and they were setting salaries and I was like, what would it actually cost to replace you if you weren't here? If I wanted to get the qualifications that you have, they've been doing this for 15 years, right? So they got 15 years of experience. These folks have degrees, da 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 da. And they're gonna sell all of that out for, well, what we can afford to pay you. And I was like, that's a broken system. That's a damaged system. And that's what I really wanna be careful of because the story of one lady, she ran her organization wonderfully for 30 years, then she died. And the organization died with her because they could not. She had done it all volunteer. She never got paid. And there was no money to actually replace her. And I thought, this is a cautionary tale for me. So I've always approached this from the perspective of what would it take to pay somebody with my skill level, 50 years of experience, to come into this place and do the work that I'm asking them to do. And I just think we really have to value that experience, the skill set, and the commitment that, it's no less. We deal with very intractable problems. It's not, if you create a nice scooter and everybody likes your scooter and you keep coming out with new models next year, people buy more scooters. That's not what we deal with. We deal with brokenness, we deal with obstacles, and we have to be darn near geniuses just to kind of break even. And people aren't, we're not making that clear in how we are paying people. I'm sorry, I talked a long time.
No, it is good. And one thing that you started with in the beginning, and where I thought you were going, and then where you went was really good. But I also want to talk about where I thought you were going, which was that whole sense that we talked about during the pandemic about what we're paying, quote, essential workers. Because so much of what you were talking about, as you started, was talking about the essential nature of the work that we're doing, and that whole drumbeat that came up during the pandemic and then went very quickly away, afterwards, is, are we paying essential workers as if they are essential? Huge, huge. And that whole replacing that one person who did it all, guilty. Yeah. Deep and incredible. Shantine, yeah.
I just wanted to piggyback off of John's really good points there, which is that I spent some time as an executive director of a women's business center, and this is, to speak to Hildy and Dimitri and Kim and everyone else who has acted as an executive director or a executive in a nonprofit. The range of duties and the range of skill and knowledge that you must bring to that role to be effective, I think, is not understood, not respected, certainly not understood by the greater populace. If you see people arguing over the salaries of executive directors of a nonprofit and you fully understand how much skill and experience it requires, it appears to be much underpaid. And so I really want to highlight that because I took that role. I enjoyed it. I was fundraising. I was managing multiple people. I was networking. I was looking at what we were paying for, how that fit into our budget. We were not funded by Small Business Administration, so we had very strict rules. You have to comply with those rules. You have to be familiar with their input system online. You have to know that back of your hand, and then also keep track of everything and make sure you're running well and everyone's happy. I mean, it's really a tremendous job that I didn't even appreciate until I stepped into the role. And this is someone coming with, almost 15 years of experience as an attorney, but I was being paid a fraction of what I would have been paid as an attorney at a law firm. And it's not to say that I wouldn't have a lot of responsibility at a law firm. It's just very different and it's not nearly as comprehensive, if I can speak very broadly. So I think to John's point, we really have to remember how important these roles are, how much it requires, and then also make sure we sell that to people in a purely marketing sense of saying the work we do is incredibly important and it also requires so much skill. You're getting the top minds here. You're getting Hildy, Dimitri, you're getting these folks who know what they're doing. So when we say that this is a salary that we need for them to do their job, it's based on principles. It's based on reality. It's not so anyone is being enriched. And by the way, if anyone here wanted to be enriched, we would not be in nonprofit sector. So that argument just stalls out. But there's a lot of people who don't understand that and don't believe it. And so I just think it's something to really highlight at the forefront of this conversation is that the work is important, as John said, and you're all underpaid, just I think as a baseline here. So we really need to put our money where our mouth is, I think, especially as creating the future, which is about dismantling these structures and refining them and making them better. We need to be at the forefront of doing that and being vocal about why we're doing it, which is exactly why we're here. It's the right thing to do.
And I'm sorry, Vu, you're in the wrong meeting. For those who are watching and did not see a little bit of snark, Vu just said, "What? I can't get rich here." Yeah, wrong place. Huge stuff. And these are the things that we like talk about when we're sitting having a second drink with somebody who's also in the sector talking about these kinds of things. But when it comes time to set salaries, we ask one question: what's the market? And which just reinforces the things that Shantine and John, you were saying at the very, very, very beginning, in terms of how we do this, and we wind up on that vicious cycle. So, what then can the way that we set salaries, what can that make possible for all of these people who are clearly affected by the way salaries are set? What could it make possible? And we've started touching on some of that.
So if I could jump in, I'm going to have to jump off the call in about 10 minutes. So I just wanted to, I think in this space, put a couple of things. I know I used the term earlier of, a living wage, but I think if we just look at what we pay people should make life balance possible. And I don't use the term work-life balance because for many people who are on this call, life is work and work is life. And so it's really life balance. So I think that really leaning into that idea of what does it look like to encourage life balance for the folks who are being employed. And I will also, I think John was touching on kind of a natural tension around employment and jobs. So For better or for worse, I think that the federal government or governments do this really well when they have the tiered ranges of jobs. They say if there is a job, here is the skill set. Within that skill set, this is the predetermined range. If you stay at that job for your entire life, you'll get cost of living adjustments, but that's sort of as far as it goes. Like, we don't, because I think we run into this problem as an organization that we pay tenure, which is generous to do, but then you do run into a situation. It's kind of the reverse of what John was talking about, which is I've worked with organizations, and the people are like, well, we were paying the person who was here for 20 years this much, but the job is like, that was way, way, way over what the job, like that market piece, if we include that. So, I mean, it's a, in some ways, a dispassionate approach, but it's saying first and foremost, the salary must encourage life balance and people thriving in their lives. That's the non-negotiable. But then I think the boundaries of what compensation is for a job, there is a bit of the meritocracy component in that. We are compensating for a set of skills, and there are limits to that. And I think, again, I do want to really honor, John, what you were putting out there, which is we structurally have issues in our sector where promotion and growth is a challenge. And so we grow people's skills without, we change position titles, those things. It's a mixed bag. I mean, that, and again, I think that's what's sort of good about the federal government. They're like, if you can't deal with this, then it is time for you to move. Like, the progress is, if we hold you here, we constrain you. Like, we don't want to pay you to keep you from actually progressing in a career because we don't have the space or the bandwidth to be able to do this. And I know there's a lot of conflicting tension components, but I just wanted to put those out there. Like, what we want to make possible is a system that is, first and foremost, life balance. Second, it does create kind of a realistic structure for the organization and the people in the organizations who have to make hiring replacements and things like that. And it graciously moves people out of our organizations when we don't have room to progress them. I'll stop there.
Kim and then Vu.
Okay, so Hilde, you know what I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I don't know if it's an appropriate place here, but I think it kind of fits. So Hilde's taught me to like ideally what would this look like for any of this kind of thing. And we've been having a lot of conversations in our organization about is it about roles or is it about skills? Do we hire for skills versus roles versus something I was told never to do is you never design a role around a person. But when that person has skills that isn't just suited to that role, but some others that it can help with in the organization, how do we draw? What can we do to draw upon that to benefit the organization and them? Because then they get to stretch further from just this one little narrow role. And so, and then we start talking about, so my job as ED, I'm responsible overall for the organization, but what makes my job so much more worth so much more money than someone who's working the front line with the people we're trying to serve? Like my job, I don't know that it's more important, it's just different. And so ideally, my dream is to have a skill set that we need for our organization. And this is, I don't know if this is the best way, but this is what we've kind of started with is how do we make sure everyone gets a really good wage that's, I don't know, equal, but like close in range to each other. So it's a really good wage that people can live on, thrive on, and everybody gets it because everybody's job is just as important as everybody else's job. And I mean, that sounds, I don't know what it sounds like, but in my head, it sounds really good. So we've been talking a lot about this, and realistically, like it's not something we can move to immediately or, but we can start making some changes, I think.
Big stuff. Vu.
Hey everyone, I'm at the airport. I don't know how loud I am being. So can y'all hear
We
me?
can hear
Yeah.
you. We can hear
Okay,
you.
good. I don't have all my thoughts completely formulated. But I do think that we need to kind of examine. A guiding question for me has recently has been like, what does the right wing do? Okay. And the right wing protects its people. And it seems like the progressives are always focused on like doing things the right way versus doing the right thing. And so we are mired in processes and what people think and doing things legally and all this stuff. Whereas if you're on the right, it doesn't matter. It's like what you could murder several protesters and people would get you a book deal and all your legal defense and pay you and get you on a podcast and get whatever is that's why they had that's why they're so effective. And so I am less concerned about like what are these? What are people going to think? I don't give a shit about that. We need to figure out what is going to be suits so that we can be effective, so that Hildy can be happy in this role, because that's what. If you were like a right wing thought leader, you'd be paid $1 million, and you have a platform and a podcast and book deals and whatever it is that you need in order to spread your ideas far and wide everywhere. So I think that's kind of maybe some of the approach we need to talk is like what does it take to keep you happy, and we can talk and like you're gonna need to raise more money because the salary is gonna have to be every single year, and then if we get staffing that we probably should talk about like some sort of ratio where the top person does not get paid more than whatever 1.5 the salary of the lowest paid staff or whatever. But at this moment I start thinking about this Claude AI fellowship that's like $85,000 for a fellow. Right, that's going to be more than most EDs are going to be making, and I don't know, they don't give a shit about that. So, yeah, I get more and more frustrated when we get mired in just processes because that's the default of progressives. It's like trying to do things based on what everyone else is doing with the laws and so on. So, why don't we just try to move beyond that and figure out like what does it take for Hildy to be happy? And to continue doing this work and for creating the future to be successful.
Yeah, that whole, I mean, basically what it comes down to is mission effectiveness. Is they're able to do the work. They're able to do the work and not worry about it and not have to be doing 17 different things.
And you get Carl's comment.
Yeah, I will do so. Somebody else raised their hand. I don't remember who. Carl said to add to Vu's point, what those people all have is security, a well-paid salary, no fear of being dismissed, no 12-month contracts, no tyranny of outcomes measures. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Yeah.
Shanti.
Yeah.
I was just going to resoundingly echo what Vu said, and Carl's points were actually exactly right on point what I was going to say. I'm probably maybe the most guilty of looking at processes because I'm a lawyer, and that's all I think about is what is the right way to do things? What's the way that's going to reduce risk? But ultimately, the question is, are you being paid enough that you can do the mission without having to divest from the mission because you can't eat, you can't get your kids childcare? I mean, what are the levels that we're concerned about? It's basic living, yes, but it's a little more than that because it's really hard to sink yourself into this work and be effective when you're not paid enough. And it's not just about getting that salary. It's to Kim's point, what are the other benefits as well? But the stability factor is the thing I think that's going to motivate people towards the nonprofit sector and not away. The government used to be sort of the model of that. Unfortunately, as someone who spent many years as a federal employee, federal attorney, most of my friends who were in the federal government are not there anymore. In the past year, they've left because the government doesn't represent that level of stability any further. And so I think to be effective as nonprofit leaders, we have to maybe step up into that position a little more, maybe take some cues from what the government was doing well with the step system. That's what I was sort of subject to. You've got the grade scale, and then you've got individual steps in between that to up for your cost of living per year. You might get a step promotion that is an annual benefit that is almost impossible to not get. And then there's also promotion potential within that to the grades, but it makes sure that people are able to keep doing their job, at a level commensurate with inflation, with things of that nature, and are able to focus on the mission and get that done, because this is work for people, which unfortunately I think is the work that is the most devalued. It is the work that's seen as the least essential, which boggles my mind, but it appears to be the way it is. So I think Carl and Boo are hitting the nail on the head.
Yeah, and what's unspoken in what both you and Vu were saying, Shantine, is not just mission effectiveness, but the whole stability of the mission. Yeah, the stability of my career. Do I know that I will have a job next year and the year after, and I can actually plan. But the effectiveness of the mission being long term and stable. We talked a couple of years ago when we were talking about succession planning. We were talking about it as continuity planning, continuity of mission, and that has directly to do with salary structure. Yeah. Angie.
So I think this is a great conversation, and I agree with the idea of stability and all the supports that Carl outlined, but I'm thinking about like on what it's based. So I'm no expert on the right, and maybe Fu has more background in this can comment, but I think a lot of it's related to like loyalty to the party, right? Or loyalty to an ideology. And I don't think that's what we're talking about here. So then there's also like, I guess, loyalty to the mission or, but the mission also sometimes is not enough, I guess. I think because right, so there's plenty of nonprofits that have missions that are not interested in changing the social structures that create these inequalities to begin with. Another model, of course, is like loyalty to the like, and I another ideology like workplace democracy or like labor organizing again that would embrace that. So I'm just thinking about like on what this is based, like the end goal, yes, but then how we get there, how it comes about, and on what it's based is important.
Yeah, I think there's some definitely different assumptions upon which right-wing funding is based, because it comes down to funding. And then it comes down to splitting hairs once the funding is there, which we're really good at doing. The angels on the head of a pin kind of thing. What else can the salary conversation, how salaries are derived, what else can that make possible for the mission, for the public perception of nonprofits? I Carl, I can't tell you how I'm reflecting on your comment earlier about I'm tired of the media focusing on how high the salaries are. When can we focus on how low the salaries are? There's such a public perception. I have been in conversation with folks who know nothing about the nonprofit world at all, like the person next to you on the airplane kind of thing, where their comment is, "Well, how do you get paid if you're a nonprofit, can you get paid?" I mean, so when we're talking public perception, we're talking about if you're paid anything, that you should be volunteering, which brings up what you were talking about, Shantine, in terms of volunteering is a privilege, in many cases, to be able to quote officially volunteer. The difference is that in many lower income communities, the work is not being done, quote, as a volunteer for a nonprofit. It is more mutual aid and more helping my neighbors. And so it depends on the label we're putting on volunteering. But there's a lot in there in terms of public perception. What can salary decisions make possible for that public perception?
Ben, if I can jump in, there was a book that used to be published here every year about 20 years ago called Voluntary Not Amateur. Partially because in the UK we don't get called the non-profit sector here, we get called the voluntary sector. But the point was is that people think that because you volunteer that you're amateur, or because you work in the non-profit sector that somehow you're amateur and you don't have the skills that are required in other sectors. And some of that does reflect that people think that someone's skills are a reflection of what they're paid. They think markets apply to everything. And we are not in a market economy in our world. And I think some of that needs explaining, it seems to me. Hilda, your point about people are completely unrealistic about what salaries are. And again, from that work we did a few years ago, when we talked to people about differentials, for example, about what's the ratio between the highest paid and either the median paid or the lower paid, we were coming out with differentials like 10, 11, 12 to 1. Whereas in the private sector, it was 120 to 1 and those sorts of figures. So there's definitely an education job to be done.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. There's a move in California. I don't remember if it's the whole state. John, you might know the whole state, or in just LA. And Eli, you might know as well, to tax the differential. So depending on what, so if the CEO makes this much more than the average employee, then your tax is what it normally would be. And if they make three times more than that, then your tax would be at a 40% level. And if you make 10 times more than that, then your corporate tax would be at an X percent level. And that they're actually taxing the corporation based on the differential between the highest paid and the lowest paid, which I think is just a brilliant workaround. We're not saying you can't pay your CEO a bazillion times more than the janitor. We're just saying we're going to tax you.
I have a comment on
Yeah, to be a treat.
that. In light of that last comment, Hildy, I know that this has been in the news lately. The CEO of Starbucks makes 6,600% or times more than the lowest employee. $95 million versus $14,000 that we're talking about. And in some of the comments that have been made here, is this person that much better, no matter what they're doing in the company, than the employees? And if they're being paid that, and I see this as being a systemic issue, if they have a lot of wealth or they're being paid a lot of money, they somehow are smarter, or that their opinions are more important or should be followed or should be whatever, even though they might be counterproductive to me as an individual, as an employee, as a state, as a nation, or whatever, because of that salary thing. And I think that also talks to the idea that we don't value based on the work, the skills, and whatever. We value purely on what's being paid. And I think that that's a huge opportunity to make a change in that so that people are valued differently.
Huge, just tremendous. Yeah, Shantine.
I think also to Dimitri's excellent point, it goes, I think, even beyond the salaries within an organization to how much funding does an organization receive? And the irony being that often the perception is the more funding, the more important that organization is, as opposed to the less funding, the less important or less critical that organization is. And we all know that's simply not true. There's a lot of very important, critical organizations that are devastatingly underfunded because they're not sexy. They're not that interesting. I love animals. I can tell you, I am more likely to go to a nonprofit or a charitable page raising money for an animal than I am, or, their care than I am for other things because it's something that appeals to me. It's cute. It's fun. When we're trying to explain what the underlying purpose is of an organization that maybe isn't as obvious to people or isn't as graspable or tangible to folks outside of the sector, it becomes a lot harder to justify the funding and also then to justify the funding for each individual who is contributing at that level. And Justin just pointed out it's a salary isn't a subjective result, it's of negotiating skill. That's absolutely right. I think One of the things that I do counsel a lot on is salary negotiation and how we can get employees what they're worth, right? And it's hard to calculate how much somebody and their effort is worth. The more objective skills and structures we put in, perhaps the better way we can calculate. But again, the perception is something that's always going to try to impede. And so I think it's why, as much as it's important to look at market and look at what the surrounding conditions state, I think it's also important to look at what we're doing and what you guys are doing directly and say, this is important. This is just as important. So we're going to demand not just the funding, but also that our employees are paid commensurate to their importance as workers in this field, as nonprofit workers, yes, but also for this mission. We don't want to underplay that simply because it's not as sexy or it's not as, and this goes for every nonprofit, it's not as publicly known. It's all about perception. So I think we just have to continue to focus and recentralize around the concept that this work is critical, full stop. And not let things detract from that along the way.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that it really leads right into what Carl was saying. And I will read that for folks who may be just watching, trying to answer Hildy's question. This makes it possible to experiment with alternative approaches to setting salary other than slightly spurious arguments about market value. I would go more than slightly spurious. So setting salaries using approaches that enhance dignity, promote organizational stability, value skills the market doesn't value, hallelujah, such as caring, and reflects our core values such as solidarity. What does it take then to set salaries? I mean, if what we are looking at really is that setting a salary in the way y'all are talking about, setting that salary for creating the future isn't enough. It's just one organization that people can then point to and say, see, they overpay them, which, by the way, I'm waiting for. But and I'll be waiting a while. But just setting that one salary doesn't make the difference. What makes the difference is having this conversation and making this more, Justin mentioned transparency about what it takes to actually accomplish the work. I think there's an awful lot to be said for and there are folks who are working. Rusty Stahl heads, I think it's called Fund the People, which is a nonprofit all about raising the salaries of nonprofit leaders everywhere. And paying a decent wage. What needs to be in place then for this not to just be about setting those salaries for creating the future, but setting those salaries in general? What conversations need to happen specifically? I'm looking at what you raised, Carl, which just word for word, experimenting with alternative approaches to setting salaries other than market value. In a way that enhances dignity, promotes organizational stability, values the skills that the market doesn't value, and reflects our core values such as solidarity. Yeah, Carl.
So the first thing I just want to say here is that it's not just salary, and just it's not my personal experience, but looking around me where I currently work at the minute, and Angie, I don't know if you've got sort of this issue, but like replacing permanent roles in organizations with lots of temporary hourly paid roles on short-term contracts and stuff like that, where people don't have dignity or stability. I see some of that going on around me. So some of it is about nature of contracts and giving people that stability that they need if they want to raise a family, and so on, never mind have a career. And then some of that experimentation, I think it probably starts off from what do people need to have a real living wage? What gives them dignity to live in a community where they are? And then what contributes to that sense of solidarity in an organization? So are there practical things that you can start to experiment with, like multiples or ratios from It's not necessarily the highest to the lowest, but the median person to the lowest. It's asking yourself, because you know, we're doing sometimes in this country, are there any, do we have any differentials in our organization between the median salary that, say, men and women receive, or those between white people and other folk? And I don't literally mean, are you paid differently for the same task, but you can look at organizations and it can surface practical things like, oh crikey, you know, like the reason that white people are paid more in our organization on average is because they're doing all the top paid roles in the organization. So you can start to surface some of these conversations. I don't think there's much value in saying that you should that the top person should only receive this much more than the middle ranking person. But at least these sorts of experiments, they highlight that something else is possible and that the market isn't the answer to everything.
Yeah,
It's a bit of a rant.
goes hand in hand with hiring policies in general. If the only thing we are looking at in a role is white men, which in our country right now this seems to be the only ones left in the cabinet, seems to be the only ones left in the military. Women and people of color who were up for promotion have been taken off the list, which it directly relates to salary, but salary is not the end result. It's just one of the things you don't get by being in those positions of power. So I think, salary almost in many of the cases of what we're talking about here, salary is sort of the symptom. Shantine.
Sorry, I'm muted again. I think what's really interesting about salary and pay in general is that we oftentimes see it as a starting point when you look at any kind of job offer that's out there. You might feel inclined, if you're the type of person to negotiate, right? You may also not feel inclined. We know, I've spent the last year researching negotiation techniques. We know that women, and other folks from underrepresented communities are less likely to negotiate for salary. They're less likely to even consider the possibility that salary can be negotiated. So when we set a number, we might be thinking, oh, this is a pretty good number. And if they have skills that maybe are a little bit above and beyond, they'll ask for more. That's not necessarily true. They may not never ask for more. They may never even consider the prospect of going into the CEO's office or whomever and having an open conversation about those salaries. So one of the things that we can do as employers is kind of take that into ourselves and say, we're going to set this at such a level that even if someone does not negotiate, this is still a benefit for them. This is still a boon. That's really hard to do, but I think it's a thing, something to keep in mind because, like I said, for the most part, there's a huge part of society that is not going to ask for more. They don't feel that they deserve more. One of the things that I've been seeing a lot out here in Portland, which I've been loving, is language in job postings to the effect of, we respect that not everybody here has the same background or the same ability to negotiate as everybody else. So we encourage you to apply for this job, even if you don't think that you have all the direct skills, because we're going to look and see what other skills you might bring, knowing that you're from a different community. You're not just the standard, cis white male who might show up and demand more. So I think if we lead with that kind of presumption that not everybody is going to know how to self-represent and that we might need to pick up some slack as employers, we're going to do better from that baseline.
You're raising something that is making my brain go, t-t-t-t-t-t-t, which is like, should we have to negotiate? I mean,
Right.
let's just start there.
That's right.
The biggest shift I've seen in my lifetime around buying a car is that there's many manufacturers that just say, here's what it costs. You can buy it or not. Because so many people hate having to negotiate a car. I go to the grocery store, I am not negotiating for the price of lettuce. I'm either buying it or I'm not. And what does it say about a person if their personality is one where they're not comfortable. I'm not comfortable. I will tell you right now, I'm not comfortable negotiating. I
Absolutely.
am one that somebody offers me a price, I'm either going to say yes or no, and I'll walk out. And you will not have me applying for something if I have to negotiate a salary. If I look at it and I go, okay, well, that salary makes sense to me, I'll do it. And otherwise, I just won't.
Absolutely.
And to have a system where we need to negotiate a salary, that alone says something to me that's, I don't know, it just doesn't, it doesn't sit right. What if we were to offer, here's what we pay, and it's wonderful, and it takes into account everything that y'all just said. You'll be able to take care of your family, and you'll be able to see a career ladder, and you'll and here's what it is.
100%.
So there's something in the whole conversation about having to negotiate that.
For comment, please.
Yeah,
I
yeah, agree. Oh,
yeah.
sorry. I just cap that
No,
off real
go
quick.
ahead. Go ahead,
I
John.
think that what you're saying is exactly right, and I love that you're thinking that way because, again, I think the presumption is that if we put a number out there and we let people negotiate, that's going to work out. And it's not the case. And the other thing we have to respect is that people might be okay negotiating certain things, but not something like a salary. So you might find that, Hildy, I know you very well. I know you're able to stand up for yourself. I know you're able to ask what you need. It's not that. That's not the same skill or the same desire to negotiate salary. So we have to also respect that people who don't want to negotiate, it doesn't mean that they're not capable. Something unfortunately I see a lot is that when someone is offered something and they don't come back with a negotiation, that's seen as a negative, that's seen as, oh, they don't know how to do it, or they don't want to, or they're not a strong person. And I think we need to wipe that off the table because that is not how a lot of people operate, and it doesn't reflect upon their ability to do the job.
Yeah.
I just had a comment on something that John said earlier about a career ladder. My observation in terms of many young people now is their career ladder is they go from company A to company B to company C, and that's their career as they're moving along. It isn't like they stay at company A until they become the CEO of company A. They build their skills, they build their, whatever reputation, and then they move on to another. If all of those jobs in the nonprofit sector were paying, I don't want to use the word living wage, but were paying commensurate to the skills and the energy going into it, that is a way of having a career path. Even though the individual organization, the Shantine, for your benefit, the cat rescue place in this small town in Oregon, probably doesn't have a huge career ladder. I mean, you're going to reach the top and that's going to be it. But if you can go from there to the cat rescue place in Portland or in wherever, that becomes a career ladder. Now, I don't know if that's practical or viable, but I was just thinking about what John had said about career, which I think is really important in terms of young people coming in, that this is also if the is what's happening in the sector is something that provides the opportunity to move into other good paying, good benefit, good whatever jobs, then that is potentially another way to have a career within that industry versus within that organization.
Yeah, I thinking about, how many nonprofits are big enough to allow for a career ladder, versus, how many have four people on staff, five people on staff, and that's that. But it is lateral. But if the salaries were commensurate and the benefits and the respect and were commensurate across the entire sector, then you're absolutely right. And yeah, Kim.
I was just thinking some of the stuff when Dimitri was talking about. So we haven't had significant turnover in almost 4 years now in our organization. In our community, that's very unusual right now. There's a lot of things happening. People are leaving for whatever reason. But I think part of it, as you were talking, that career idea, that ladder, we're small. We don't have a ladder. But what we do have is opportunities for people to work outside their role. And so they get to work on projects. They get to, like, we call them passion projects, things like that. Like, so we're engaging them and helping them grow different skills, even though their role technically isn't changing. And so it's about salary, but I think it's a lot about all of these other pieces too, where like I kind of minimized it, but being able to go pick up your kids from school at a time, being able to choose your work day. So I have a staff person, we're trying it out because we had never thought of it before, but she is one of those people that feels really energized at certain times of the day, but also on the weekend is where she knows she has to do meetings and things, but otherwise she's flexing her work around everything. And when she feels productive is when she's working and she's meeting her outcomes. Like, so like it's these things, the different ways of thinking, and being able to adapt to the person you have, because that's what we do in our organization is whoever's there, we're going to adapt to them as much as possible, to make sure that they're having an engaging experience. It's not just a job they have to do. And like I said, like we can't pay tons of money. We've got my big thing, and I hate to say it at this point, but my big thing when I took over was I got everyone up to a living wage because we hadn't had anything significant in, I think it was almost 8 years by the time I was there. And I was in the organization that long. So it is what it is, but we're trying to make sure at least cost of living raises each year, that kind of thing now. But it's hard because the funders don't fund that way. So we have to figure out how to do it in different ways. But
It
it's
is,
important to us, so we're figuring it out.
yeah, and it's huge because systemically we work within a system of dependency. So, that it's not, at any time I'm speaking anymore, I'm talking about the fact that we need to stop calling it a scarcity mindset because it's not a scarcity mindset, it's a scarcity reality. Yeah, John.
Yeah, to a couple, a lot of different things. I think when we talked about the not negotiation thing, I just want to start there. A lot of times, if you're me walking into a job, you're willing to kind of negatively negotiate. It's like I'm willing to give up some things in order to be able to do this. And it fits into what you were saying, Dimitri, a little bit. Because in doing this, I'm actually going to increase my skill set so that I can go to whatever next thing is. But I'm not really coming in to say, to kind of blow my horn, to say what I'm capable of doing. I'm not going to negotiate real hard because they don't want people like me there in the first place. And so there's a real, it's not just I'm not willing to negotiate, it's that. I'm literally begging for a job. I mean, let's kind of put it to what it is. I think we don't recognize that a lot of times. And I think that's a big handicap. Like you said, it's not a scarcity mentality, it's a survival mentality. But it also is compounded by the fact that when we talk about the future of an organization, we recognize that you probably got funded if you're really lucky, you got a 3-year grant, which means you kind of know what money you're going to get for the next 3 years, but you don't know what money you're going to have beyond that 3 years. And a lot of times it's for a year. And so you don't even know if you can keep me next year. And so I can't go in there really expecting to negotiate that, okay, in 5 years, this is where we're going to be, because I don't think we're going to be in 5 years. And I think we have to break that cycle because it creates a stability. When we talk about sustainability, and it's not a, there's no sustainability, there's no stability. And so we're really, if we don't change that, then the thing we're trying to build has no legs, because it's always going to be, oh, well, next year when our funding runs out, blah, 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 blah. And so, and I live with organizations that go through that, every summer comes, you're really happy to give people time off in the summer because number one, you don't got the money to pay them in the first place. So I think there's a reality to, and there's no, no way that I hate to say this, there's no capital base for actually having longevity in the business. And without that base, without, what Vu said was so right. They got money in boxes and corners, so they don't really care. Whereas we're begging for like what fell out the box. And as a result, we really are living off the leftovers of everybody's stuff. And as long as we're doing that, this can't get right. And I hate to say it that way, but that's really, and I want to say one other thing. Kim, I know you're doing a great job and I get where you are and what you're doing. But at the same time, I wouldn't tell my daughter or my son or my grandchildren they should get into this business. You know what I'm saying? Because I love them more than that. I hate to say it that way. And if we can't create jobs that we would recommend to our children and grandchildren, what the heck are we doing? So I'm sorry.
There's no I'm sorry there. Oh my gosh. You are singing the song that, oh boy, oh Kim. Kim just wrote, my son just got hired by a nonprofit and I cried a little. And I'll tell you, John, one of the reasons that we have not hired in the past at Creating the Future when we have had the money to do so is specifically because it would have to be a 1-year contract. Because I can't guarantee that we're going to have that money next year. And what you're saying is so spot on. And so it is way bigger. I mentioned before, I think the salary issue is a symptom of a larger issue of financial stability and the ability, the valuing of this work. And the fact that nonprofits are now under attack, and just sort of, quadruple that because folks who were confident in getting federal contracts because they've gotten them for 10 and 20 and 30 years, now are not only not confident, but are being brought to court for the work that before for 30 years we funded you and now we're bringing you to court because you're doing that work and we don't like it now. So I think that there's huge cycles. So when we're talking about this, what then should creating the future, looking very specifically at us, what should we be considering when we are setting salaries for the next couple of years? So the funding we get, we will anticipate will be to take us through the next 3 years maximum, probably 2 years, of what it takes to complete Creating the Future's mission. So we will not be looking at instability if over 10 years because we're not looking for 10 years of funding. We're going to be looking for a finite amount for a finite time frame, which is a luxury and a privilege. And I totally get that in every bone of my body. I do think this conversation, though, is way more valuable than any dollar amount. I just first want to thank you all for that. But as we are considering, okay, over the next couple of years, setting a salary for, let's say, let's not even call it for the CEO. Let's call it for whoever's going to run that project of the entire documenting everything that we've done, which happens, by the way, to be me. What should we be considering when it comes to setting that salary? Where should we even start? Do we start with the market? Do we start with where do we start? What do we need to know? What do we need to be considering?
I'll circle back to Carl's earlier point, but about what's needed to feel secure, to feel that you can maintain, that stability, dignity. I'm looking at your other message, but what do you need to live a rich life, I guess?
Well, I could do it for half what the CEO of Starbucks is doing. I would even do it for an
So,
eighth, a tenth.
you're underlining the word rich, the rich life. I
I'll do it
mean,
for a
like,
tenth.
yeah,
Yes, you can define rich in different ways.
I would feel stable for a tenth of what the CEO of Starbucks is making. And maybe even a 20th of what Elon Musk is making. But what do we need to be considering? Yeah. And so what is a measure of that? What does it take to have a livable, comfortable, assured life balance? I loved Justin's phrasing of life balance. Where does one start with that? Yeah, Carl.
Well, I think the starting point is a feeling of security, as in you can pay whether it's a mortgage or rent or something, so that you have somewhere to live, that you can buy what you need in terms of provisions and food. And there are measures here in the UK where estimates of been produced to sort of come up with what's the minimum salary that you need to live life as a citizen. So in other words, it's not just when you pay your mortgage and food, it's also that you have a little bit of leisure time and you can do some leisure things and sort of, so there will be sort of things like that, it seems to me, that you take into account. The other thing that I think for an organization like us that we sort of take into account is what's going to make your job easier is not the word I'm looking for, but what's going to give you the maximum ability to perform your role in terms of the perceptions of you and how much you're paid. So, in other words, what do we pay you in a way that enhances the values that we espouse and the practices that we're asking other people to do? So, in other words, we've always made a big deal about walking the talk. So if we were, let's say we were in a position where our funder gave us a huge amount of money, and we could afford to pay you millions of dollars or sort of something like that. I mean, there's an argument there that whilst we might be able to do it, it would actually make your job much harder and probably make you unhappy because no one would trust us anymore and so on. And coming back to something Justin said earlier, I think in the text.
Thank you, Boo.
Thanks, Phil. It's not just about how much you paid. It's about being transparent about how did we arrive at the decision about how much you were paid. That might start with being public about the salary that you're paid. It might be about being clear about what are the things that we take into account when we set your salary. I might go as far to say that I don't think people would object to any particular salary if we had a clear justification about what's behind that, and especially if that justification was that it reflected our values and where we were coming from.
Huge. Yeah, Shantine.
All of those are excellent points. And one of the things that, of course, I have to think about is the reasonableness factor is something that is essential for nonprofit salaries. It's unfortunately an unavoidable consideration because it is what the IRS is going to look at on Form 990 and how you're going to be assessed as a nonprofit. So if we want to be creative, but also make sure that we're meeting things like the standard of living, but also exceeding it perhaps, to I think Kim's point earlier about how do we meet the workers where they are, we can look at the demographics and the type of folks who are likely to apply for a given role. Of course, that with how the world is now, that they may be able to re work remotely from another location, that might affect this consideration. But we know, for example, that nonprofits tend to be disproportionately hiring and also apply to by women. So one of the things that we might want to consider is caregiving as an option, making sure that there's maybe there is a childcare unit on site. That is something you can offer to someone to make their life better and essentially cover them for a lot of money, but without having to apply that to salary. And this is the way that you can avoid the scrutiny from the IRS of saying, oh, well, I don't like that you're paying this person who's not a CEO this much money. Okay, well, instead, we'll pay them a good amount. We'll pay them probably more than market, because I think market is generally underselling the situation. But also, we're going to provide these other benefits that are not calculable as salary, but are effectively supplementing and subsidizing someone's livelihood. And those are the types of things that I think nonprofits are very good at being creative about because we care about people. And so we ask them questions. What is it that we can do for you that'll make your life easier? So you can, set those things out, but also as you hire, talk to them and say, this is the salary. There might be limits that we have as a nonprofit funding base, also based on the market, but what would make it easier for you? Do you have a dependent at home? Is it an elder that you're caring for? How can we maybe help you do that? So there are ways to be creative, I think, that are go beyond the salary restrictions, and it just involves looking at the individual and really caring about what they need, and then possibly expanding that as a broader benefit for the other employees that you have or potential future employees, which can also be a very attractive thing for people when they're looking to apply.
Yeah, very much. Very much. Yeah, Angie.
I wanted to bring in, I'm glad you brought in the benefits. And I was thinking about that we should be concerned not just with like enabling you or whomever's in this role, if you go for in the future, for the here and now, but also the future, right? Like, especially unfortunately in the US, like healthcare, having enough retirement savings to be able to make sure that you have care going forward for as long as you need it, should be part of our thinking and calculation and as well.
What else? What? So where does one go? We're starting at the beginning. Next week we're going to have a salary of X. What are we going to base that salary on?
Comment.
Yes, Dimitri.
I know it's not super scientific, but there are all of these studies that have been done, starting in the teens, on what level of income does someone need to feel comfortable and not basically scared in their life.
Yeah, Carl was starting to talk about that. Yeah.
And it varies, but let's say between 80 and 150,000. If I was going to pull numbers out of the air, and I'm pulling numbers out of those studies, I should say. Okay, I'm not making those numbers up. So I think if one was to be looking at a baseline, it would be nice to be striving toward that baseline. And I think Shantine, the point about the IRS and what's reasonable. I mean, here's all these studies talking about this. It seems like, we're not making this up. And then beyond that, there could, skill level and many other things can come into that. There's an intangible thing dealing with someone like Hildy who has this reputation. What's that worth? And is also a thought leader coming up with all kinds of new ideas and things. Now, I'm not saying that other CEOs of nonprofits don't do that, but I think that there is some ability to look at that and to gauge that as part of the calculation that's being made for whatever the individual is, or whoever, in this case, at Hildy.
You know, I'm you, Dimitri, and Carl specifically, both of you, having raised the livability versus the market. And what is striking me is that we so often start the conversation with the market. And what you're talking about, and that market number, we tag something to that market number as something that says this is what makes it reasonable. This is well, if John Smith down the hall is doing it, then the keeping up with the Joneses kinds of thing. If it's okay for them, then it's okay for us. And what y'all are talking about is flipping it, and rather than the market being the barometer or whatever, yeah, that thermometer, the what is a livable wage? What does it take to, I liked your phrasing, Dimitri, to not be scared, to have confidence, to feel stable. It's a different starting question. Yeah, Carl.
Hilde, you've just made me think that the market rate it's not a reflection of how the market actually works, it seems to me. The market rate is a justification for increasing the salary of those at the top, and it's a justification for decreasing the salary at the bottom.
Let's not do that. Anything else that you all think would be important for us to consider? I'm really loving the approach of rooting it in what it is. You know, it was the first thing that Justin said in terms of making that life balance possible and people thriving in their lives. And having that as the first question, because as you noted, Dimitri, those studies are out there, and you said it as well, Carl. Those studies are out there, just like market salary studies are out there. Those studies are out there, John. Yeah.
I think the only other thing, and I apologize, I had to get on a call, so I hope nobody said this, but it's really what the work is that we are looking to do, and what the outcomes are that we want to achieve. I think we have to be really clear about that. I think too often it's like we're going to put somebody in a job and they're going to get it done, but what is it? In that conversation right there. You know, and I think when I think about this job, it's like part archivist, it's part consultant, it's part trainer, it's part, you know, partnership builder. There's a lot of aspects to this work. And I want to look at it for two reasons. One, those things that we're going to ask people to do, we want to be clear. And I think number two, that the value of the work, you know, when we talk about the fact that again, our work is typically discounted because, you know, we just work in the nonprofit sector, right? We don't really do anything important. When we think about how important we really think catalytic thinking is, then we ought to really have some clear understanding of what we're getting ready to do to put that on in the proper perspective. Because that's not an easy ask. You know, that's a big ask, really. I mean, I think there's what we're doing is so important. And I think we just need to be really clear about that in the work we do. Because people don't just want to do work for the money. They want to do work for the meaning. And I think that we need to make sure we're really clear how meaningful this work is. I'm
Yeah.
sorry. That's big.
It's tremendous.
Yeah.
I will share with you, because Dimitri's sort of off mic, that Dimitri is sitting here whispering, "That's big. That's big." So, yeah. And the transparency about how we arrived at the decision. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about the 990. I'm thinking about the tax form that we fill out for the government every year. And that highest paid employee usually is on there someplace. And then there is an entire schedule that is explain yourself, tell your story. And we use that a lot. And what we have used it for in the past is to talk about the fact that our dollar numbers do not reflect the work being done. Because if you look at the dollar numbers, we're so low, we're so tiny, that one would think we do nothing. And there's been years where our total is $30,000, 40,000. I don't know that we've had $100,000 a year, but we have had more volunteers and more, I mean, including the fact that Dimitri and I volunteer so much of our time. That we have had more people helping in all kinds of different ways, providing assistance that is not monetary. And anybody who doubts the work that we're putting out, it ain't $30,000 worth of work. We've also, many of you have probably seen our newsletter recently that talked about how we budget. How does one budget when you're not, I always use the diaper bank or a food bank as the comparison. A food bank frequently will say, we've got a $12 million budget and only $100,000 or $1 million of that is in cash, because the rest of it is all donated, is all volunteer, is all food donations, whatever. To be looking at it differently, and we talk about that a lot in our 990 when we file, and we've got that page that we can do that. This says, okay, now explain yourself. And we have the opportunity to do so. As we are wrapping up, is there anything else? Because we will be considering salaries, and we will bring that to you all as our integrity body. I love the fact that what we're talking about here is not, quote, the decision, but how we'll know the decision is the right one. And the ability to, as we've said in the past, that this board's job is to determine if we are adhering to our values and adhering to catalytic thinking as we're making decisions. We will bring back what we come up with and let y'all know what it is, and it will fit these criteria. Yeah, Shantine, and then let's take a moment with reflection as y'all are looking at your notes or taking a deep breath to about this conversation. Shantine, go.
Wonderful conversation. And the only other thing I would add is that, to the extent possible, this may make it a little bit easier. And I'm sure you've thought about this, but I've seen so many people not do this, which is just to look at the work being done on the hourly basis that it's required to be done. So most nonprofit workers are probably working over 40 hours a week. We know this to be true. But we categorized, I think the tendency is always to look at the 40-hour work week and to use that as the driving guideline. And so when we look at multipliers, we say, okay, your hourly, let's whatever that is, $17 an hour, $45 an hour, 40 days, 40 hours a week. Okay, well, that looks like this much on a weekly basis. But that does not actually reflect the work that's being done. Of course, the skills and all of that other stuff that helped the person get to that point is important to kind of look at and calculate. But then the nitty-gritty, is this really a 40-hour job a week job? Is there a lot of travel time? Is the expectation that this person is going to be available on the weekends and possibly need childcare? But that they're in a role that just may happen. I mean, there's so many times where I've had to go to a networking event on a Saturday night. And that's just the job, right? Or that I've given trainings. This was a common feature of my work at the Women's Business Center. I would work an 8 to 9 hour day, then I would go home, and then I would give trainings for women that were usually an hour or two a night. And that was part of the job. I was happy to do it. But that is also more time, more energy, as a time away from me being able to cook for my family. It's a time away from gardening, whatever it happens to be. So really just looking at the actual hardcore numbers can get us to a point of just establishing the most basic baseline. And then from there, we can add on to that and really use catalytic thinking and kindness and compassion to look at other things as well.
Tremendous. Yeah.
Quick comment on Shantine.
Yeah, Dimitri.
On what you were just saying, Shantine, you don't know the number of times that Hildy wakes up in the middle of the night and goes, "Oh my God, I know how to phrase this, or I know how to write this, or totally forgot to do this." So you need to include that 20 minutes of her writing it down, and then the hour and a half it took her to fall back to sleep because of that. But it is all-encompassing. It isn't 40 hours. But I was just chuckling, thinking about what you were saying and what the reality has been around here.
He's talking about last night, even. reaching over in the dead of night to dictate into my phone. Yeah.
I believe it.
Yep. Thank you all for this conversation. Deep breath. And if you've taken any notes, circle anything that's standing out to you. And let's just take a moment to reflect what is standing out to you from this conversation. Yeah,
I was just,
Carl.
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, Angie. Killer line from John. Are we creating jobs that we don't want our kids to do? I mean, that's really got me in the back of my throat.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Angie.
I just that's a really good one. Now I should have gone before you, Carl. Shantine, I was just thinking about like we actually pay people for the kind of work that is not paid, right? The emotional labor, the getting up in the worrying, getting up in the middle of the night, worrying about other people, the all those things that should be accounted for and how we value them, but we don't support them and we should, right?
Yeah, big. John, Kim, what's standing out to you guys?
I think two things. This isn't about hours and tasks. This is really about making an enjoyable and effective experience happen. And I think we have to get to that part of it. If we can be at the heart of it's a something I'll be happy in my last days thinking about, then this was a good experience.
Wow. Wow. Kim?
Just thank you for the resources. I said we've had these conversations, so it's nice to see some other resources popped up into the chat there. Also, just appreciate this conversation in general, as I do with anything that I go to with Hildy, and that your board operates the way it does. I'm trying to get my board to kind of think about things like this. So this is great. So thank you for letting me participate, and hopefully I didn't talk too much.
No, and thank you for kittens. Thank you for kittens.
Always have those, Hilda. You didn't send me the message that said don't get another one, so I did.
I'm sure this is my fault now.
Shanti's all important.
Just send him down to Portland. It's not far. Dimitri, how about you?
I'm going to pretend that Carl didn't go first and also say that I really appreciated John's comment because it transcends everything we're doing. If we're talking about our children and we're talking about the future, then it really transcends the individual day-to-day things. And I really found that a real powerful lens to be looking at all of this through. Sort of reflecting on that.
And couple of things are really standing out to me. And yes, the would we want our kids to work in this is like the mindset shifts are the ones that are really that are sticking with me. Carl, you started out early talking about shifting the conversation from how high the pay is to how low the pay is. That whole public perception about people are just ripping off and this the conversations happening in the US Congress right now are just disgusting about there was actually a hearing last year, the title of which was NGOs Gone Wild. And that's Congress. That's the US Congress. The thought that they're making too much money rather than the reality. That was a real shift for me, and I really love the shift of moving away from what is the market paying to what are other data around what it takes to actually live a decent life. There's just some simple mindset shifts that we're talking about here within a very complex system. And the acknowledgement that we're operating within a system that leaves us dependent, that makes it unstable as a baseline. But those mindset shifts are really, I'm looking forward to re-listening to this conversation. I'm really looking forward. I've actually put some time stamps on, make sure, when John said this was at 10:42 to re-listen. So thank you all. If as we go along, anybody's got any other thoughts, send them our way. We will let you know what we land on, and it will adhere to everything that we set out here. And to me, just as a process comment, I love the fact that as a board, we've made the decision that our job is integrity to our values. That leaves us the checklist of if we set a salary, what does it have to accomplish? What does it have to do? You've given us the checklist, which is way different than we've determined as a board that the salary is X. That we get to look and we get to do the homework and we get to do all of that and bring it to you rather than, again, having to negotiate, you saying this is what it is and play within that. It's just a different perception. And that integrity body, laying out, here's the values, y'all figure it out, is way different and just feels different. So thank you guys. And I don't know that we'll get together next month, but as things come up, we will keep having these conversations. And I know that things are going to come up more and more as we start digging into stuff. So thank you all, and we'll see you, if not next month, soon.
Thank
Thank you.
you.
Thank you. Great to see all
Bye.
of
Thanks,
you.
everyone.
Wonderful conversation
Bye,
as
everyone.
usual. Bye.
Bye, everyone.